Shabbat Shalom and welcome to Dat Shalom. Here in LA, we're a little more laid back, a little more easygoing. We have no filters and we certainly can't control our podcast host. So this has been your obscenity warning.
And with that, we would like to introduce Stephanie, Mark, and Liel.
Hello, Los Angeles! This is Unorthodox, the universe's leading Jewish podcast, at least according to Apple. I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined as ever by Tablet Deputy Editor Stephanie Butnick.
Hi.
And Tablet Senior Writer Liel Leibowitz.
Do you know what that sound we just heard is?
What was that?
That was the universe telling us to move to this beautiful city. We're a polar vortex is 53 degrees.
There's a courtyard at the synagogue, and it's like balmy out there.
We were walking through when we arrived, and I said, wait a second, where have we seen this courtyard, this synagogue architecture before? And we remembered it was the temple in West Palm Beach, Florida, where they also built a synagogue around a courtyard with palm trees and people, you know, wearing leis and things like that. It's how
you build synagogues when you're happy.
I think that's right. We all got on the plane in New York and it was actually 0 degrees. And we have had a 60 degree bump in our moods. We are live tonight at Congregation of Dat Shalom in West Los Angeles.
Yay!
With three very special guests, we are excited to welcome Persian Jewish social entrepreneur Rachel Sumac. Actress, writer, and producer Lauren Miller-Rogan. And veteran TV writer and now executive producer of the show Blackish, Jonathan Groff. It's so hard, you know, it's hard enough to get a Gentile, and then when you get one, they have a Jewish sounding name. It's like, then you get Jonathan Groff, and he's the Gentile of the week. It's like, you can't win.
But is he?
Yeah, we may have some surprises.
We have some surprises, right?
This happens very frequently. We're so proud because we think we know a Gentile, and then we go on air and be like, what?
They're like, actually, my mother's mother is Jewish. I'm like, you are not a Gentile.
And you want to blame the producers, but they've done their homework. Like, they have found people who've actually, like, you know, had First Communion and whose last name is O'Brien. And then you put those people on a Jewish podcast and they start opening up and you discover that, in fact, they are 1/8 Jewish and it's their mother's mother's
mother.
They're,
like, speaking Yiddish by the end.
but that's exactly what Stephanie said. Like, there's always this, like, little bit of insecurity. Well, I don't know if it counts, but my mother and her mother and her mother are Jewish. And I was bar mitzvahed and spent 2 years in the yeshiva. And Does that count? I think it is.
Yeah, so we don't know any Gentiles is the takeaway.
Basically. So excited to be here in Los Angeles. I don't see these guys as much as I would like to, and I'm curious, like, what's, and we didn't fly in together. Usually we fly in together, but Stephanie, what's up since I last saw you?
Well, what's up is that I'm sitting in the most comfortable chair I've ever sat in, and I have the best posture. We're like in real temple. These are like temple chairs.
It's like when you're board president, you get to sit during high holidays behind the ark. The good chairs.
I feel like I never want to get up. Yeah. So it's also like very plush. I like this place.
We're more righteous already.
Definitely. Yeah. How was your flight in?
My flight in was good. I watched some classic films that I had never seen before. Ghostbusters.
I love that Ghostbusters counts as classic cinema for you.
And Goodfellas, which was great because I feel like you may have heard me at our last live show talking about how I started watching The Sopranos. And so watching Goodfellas, I feel like I understand The Sopranos. Like, I get why, like Dr. Melfi, I'm like, oh, it's funny because she was also in that. And like Christopher's in it. I feel like I'm really like clued into.
It's a whole new world that's opening up to you.
Whole new mob cinema world.
Because I'm only on season 2 of The Sopranos. Don't tell me what happens.
I thought you weren't going to stick with it. You decided to stick with it?
It's weirdly soothing to watch.
Because it feels so pre-Trump, right? It's like, sure, things were bad, but, you know.
Yeah.
So that was your airplane experience, was watching classic movies. My airplane experience, and this is 1,000% true, and it's going to be documented on Instagram after Shabbat, because I have photos.
And he knows what Instagram is.
And I've heard what Instagram is. I have Instagram minions who are going to put it on Instagram for me. Is that I was on the flight this morning, the 7 a.m. Delta flight from JFK, and about 10:30 L.A. time, so we had almost landed, like we were about to land, my last chance to get up, go to the bathroom. I get up, standing outside the bathroom, waiting in line, and I see a ultra-Orthodox guy, looks like a Hasidic guy, and he's putting on tefillin. And thinking that I'm going to like play my Jew card, right? I'm going to be like I'm down with the Jews. I'm like I'm a leading Jewish podcaster. I decided to strike up a conversation with him, and I said,
"I'm down with the Jews." It's such a soothing thing for a Jew to hear. Yeah.
Some of my best friends.
That's right. So I said to him, it's about again 10-ish in the morning. The lights, up, and I said, "Oh, you didn't daven shacharit in New York?" And he said, and he turns to me and says, well, actually, he's putting on the tefillin and he stops and he says, well, actually, I didn't have time there, but it's not yet afternoon here and halachically I can still do it, whatever. And then he says to me, and I should have seen this coming, he says, by the way, have you put on tefillin today?
And you have nowhere to run. You can't say like, oh, I'm really busy and then walk down the street because you're in C30J, like you're stuck.
So it's like, it shows how deep into the Jewish world I am that I didn't figure he was Chabad. He could have been Breslover. He could have been non-Hasidic yeshivish. He could have been a pupov. Like, he could have been any kind of, but of course he's Chabad. He's a Lubavitcher. So I have nowhere to run. So initially I was like, no, I'm good. I'm good, man. I'm good. But then I thought, wait a second. There's literally 20 rows of, and it's one of the big jumbo jets. So there's 3, 4, and 3. So there's 300 people watching us. As this guy says to me, will you put on tefillin? And I thought, I've got to represent. So he wraps me up in tefillin, and his wife, who's like 20, they just got married 3 months ago, is taking pictures, and she's, so I put on the tefillin, and then he says to me, and then we start chatting, and I said, what's your name? I said, it's Mark. I said, what's yours? He says, Yossi. I said, I could have guessed that. And I said, what's your last name? Because I like making friends. And he says, Rubashkin. And I go, wait a second. I was like, I know that name. And I looked at him and I said, I know that name. I said, is your father some sort of famous Rav or something? Is he a great Hasidic master? Is he? And he says, no, my father was the first person pardoned by President Trump. And he just owns it. He leans right in. I said, oh, the kosher slaughtering guy, the tax evasion. He said, yep, that's my dad. Postville, Iowa, agriprocessors, that's his father. And we start talking. Anyway, long story short, the punchline is also his wife grew up on my street in Springfield, Massachusetts. But that's like the least interesting thing about this story. So, Liel, how have you been? Can you top that, Liel?
I can't, but I can tell you that there are a few things that I love more than putting tefillin on planes. It feels to me like, you know how in Disneyland...
You actually wrap the tefillin on the plane or
so
putting
great.
On tefillin well, when you're on an airplane?
Well, that would be a real artistic thing. But like when you put in tefillin on a plane, you know how in Disneyland you could pay like another $100 for like skip the line pass? Like you get straight to the top. Like I feel that way too. Like God, like I'm here. I'm closer to you than all those, schlubs down on earth. Like, come on. Like I could say a little special something, something today.
I feel like you are like BSing about how religious you are. Like, I don't believe you put tefillin on an airplane.
Swear to God, I did it.
Don't believe it.
I did it 5 days ago. And not only that, en route to the Holy Land.
Wow. So that
Which
comes
is
double.
Extra point.
Did double have, plus in oh, yeah. space. Yeah.
Did you have the minion in the back by the bathrooms? Did you have some people to rap with?
Or? I did, but I don't think they really accepted me. I sort of stood like to the back and to the right because they kind of look at me like you don't have a hat. your beard's like an inch and a half shorter.
I like how real you just got with him there because Liel has been on a kind of journey toward more observance in the 3.5 years we've been doing this podcast, and you just kind of.
Calling him out.
You called him out, like, yeah.
Well, I was the one at the front of the services earlier who the rabbi had to say, no, we turn this way for this portion. So I'm open, I'm transparent about my my observance.
Yeah, absolutely. We take all kinds. News of the Jews. Leo, what's the update on Jerusalem's stray cats?
Well, some of you who've been listening to this podcast for a while would recall that we spoke about something that we... fondly called the Meowschwitz, which was a plan by the Israeli government to indeed catch and destroy all feral cats in Israel, of whom there are, 6 million. You'll be happy to hear that we've reversed course, and now Jerusalem has decided officially to invest $25,000 in buying cat food for the cats.
How much cat food does $25,000 buy? I don't know.
A lot.
But hopefully a lot.
By the way, 100,000 shekels sounds so much better than $25,000.
Totally true.
I was like, 100 shekels of cat food? Cat food for days.
It's like, here is falafel, you eat.
It's delicious. I'm really, like, this is one of my favorite ongoing storylines of our News of the Jews.
The cats in
Israel.
And not just because it gives Liel a chance to make his Auschwitz pun.
No, I feel very,
It's everything we love.
My favorite story lately in the New York Times was about Michael Cohen. He's trying to get into Otisville in New York. It's the Jewish prison. And it was like the greatest article that like kind of veered into anti-Semitism a little bit. But you're like, no, tell me more about this Jewish prison. So I'm just going to read you a quote from it. So it says, there are kosher vending machines in the visiting room. The prison commissary sells skull caps for $6 and offers a kosher selection that includes matzah, gefilte fish, arugula, and seltzer. Do you know how to pronounce arugula? And here's a quote from a former inmate. Hey, it's not Zabar's and it's a little overpriced, but what do you want? It's prison. And I'm like, I want to go to Otisville to see this Jewish prison. And that quote was from an inmate whose name is Lawrence Dressler, and he was hyperlinked in the article, so I like hovered my mouse, and it linked to LarryNoodles.com. So I clicked, and Larry Noodles, which is what Lawrence Dressler was known, was like that was his name in Otisville, he blogs about Jews in prison. And I cannot stop reading Larry Noodles' blog.
Which, by the way,
it is so crazy. But the craziest thing that I learned from Larry Noodles' blog is that the two most recent like arrivals at Otisville are Billy McFarland, the Fyre Festival guy, and the Situation from Jersey Shore.
Whose so like, mother's mother's mother is actually Jewish.
So like they're really diversifying the place, and I'm happy for them.
I have to tell you, I'm a little upset. I mean, I share your enthusiasm.
For Larry Noodles.
For Larry Noodles. But I'm a little bit upset, like, until we get, like, a badass Jewish prisoner, like, his nickname had to be Larry Noodles.
Well, it was like Larry Kugel didn't have
right,
the same ring.
This is Kevin Kugel. Don't mess with him. He'll shiv you with a matzah. Like, that's just wrong.
You know, I'll serve time in Otisville is Shalom Rubashkin, the agroprocessors guy. They all go to Otisville.
Yeah, I read about him, actually, on the blog.
So Sid, my wife, she read this article. She sent it to me, and she said, you see this article in the Times about the Jewish prison? It's kind of anti-Semitic, don't you think? And then I read it, and my only thought was, I can't believe I got scooped on this. Like, how did I not know about Otisville? How did we not do
a live
show? Have
we not done a segment there?
Yeah, on Otisville. We got to do a live show.
Like Johnny Cash.
Exactly.
Live from Otisville.
That's right. So back in Israel, Liel, Rabbi Yuval Ovadia did something that is made for Liel Leibowitz on News of the Jews.
He had very troubling news for me this week. He went on YouTube.
Who is this? Just a random person? This is a somewhat
known Israeli rabbi to warn us all that the planet Nibiru will soon crash into Earth unless all Jews immediately move to Israel. You may ask what the planet Nibiru is. You may feel a little bit relieved to know that it technically doesn't exist. But the other part of the logic, I don't mind so much the fact that the planet doesn't exist in as much that the solution to this, you know, supposed, you know, cataclysm is for all Jews to move to Israel. Like, how, in the disaster movie that is this, right, the Ben Affleck movie that is this scenario, like, what is the moment in which, like, someone rushes into the command center and says, sir, the only solution is to get all the Jews to, like, argue in one place and their energy will divert planets. Like, what is...
My initial thought was like, oh, so they'll get all the Jews to Israel and then it's going to like, what, hit America? Like, what is the logic?
They get all the Jews to Israel and then they put a huge air roof around planet Earth. And
like
the planet
force field.
Nibiru just goes to the left.
Our first Jewish guest this week is Rachel Sumek. She is the founder and CEO of Swipe Out Hunger, the leading nonprofit in addressing hunger on college campuses. Her work has been recognized by the Obama White House of blessed memory, the New York Times, and landed her on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So Rachel, tell us a little bit about Swipe Out Hunger and how it began.
I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for having me. I feel like the most perfect example of what Swipe Out Hunger is happened about a week ago when a student from a school in Denver, Madeline, heard the ad about me being on the show and looked up Swipe Out Hunger. She's a student at a school in Colorado and filled out a form to start a chapter at her school because of an ad. So I'm hoping that by the end of this podcast, we're going to have hundreds of students from across the country reach out. We're going to end college student hunger because of this, which is our mission. Swipe Out Hunger aims to address hunger amongst college students by allowing students to donate the extra money from their meal plans to other students on campus. And for those of you rolling your eyes of how are college students going hungry, or has anyone told them about ramen noodles, it's actually a really big problem in the US. About 1 in 3 college students regularly skips meals. It's the same student that from kindergarten through 12th grade got free breakfast and lunch at school. In New York, it's about 75% of students, around 70% of students in LA. Those are their primary meals of the day. And with all these supportive programs helping them get to college, no one is asking where their meal's coming from now.
Can I just ask, by the way, is this to you a Jewish project somehow?
It's the most Jewish thing I do every day. And I'm on the board of my synagogue. And still, this is the most Jewish thing I do every day. Because I remember I walked into my Hillel as a 19-year-old, and I was doing one of the internships, and we had to come up with a Jewish project. And the person who was the program director at the time, Jason, said, why don't you just take the Swipe Out Hunger thing that you're doing and make that your project? I'm like, yeah, but it's not Jewish. He's like, no, it's Jewish. And so in that moment, it was like 2011, 2010, when Judaism realized that it can attract millennials if you start to talk about social justice and Judaism at the same time. But it's absolutely me putting my values into place of making sure if there are resources, how can we make sure that everyone has access to them? It's a very I think like Jews are pretty commonsensical. We say things that make sense, and it made sense that if I have money in my meal plan, if there are amazing dining halls on campus, and if there are people who are walking past this dining hall every day who are struggling to eat, that we should connect the dots.
So this makes
charity
me...
and feeding people. How much more Jewish could it get?
This makes me sad because I remember you had to have like a certain amount of food points, and I was in. I'm going to my 10-year college reunion, so it was like vaguely I remember this. At the end of the semester, you always had like tons of food points, and we used to go to the hotel whose restaurant had like a fancy restaurant, and they accepted food points because it was like a Duke affiliated. It was called the Waduke, and we'd all like splurge on these crazy meals.
Like,
and
I'm thinking, how insane
is it that we were just being such idiots? And actually, yeah. What we could do now is donate those to people in need.
The student who reached out to us from Duke said, "I saw my friend buy a bottle of Dom Perignon with his meal points, and that's when I knew I needed to do something."
Yeah, that was me. I bought that.
How did the idea come? I mean, how do you connect the dots? How do you, must be so many pieces technologically, software wise, like what?
Yeah, I love telling the founding story because you'll see me on stage and you'll think that I was like some genius Mother Teresa. It was my friend who posted a Facebook status, Brian, and he's like, who wants to do this thing with our meal points? And I knew how to use Photoshop. So I said, I'll help you make the flyers and I'll show up to help volunteer. And I showed up and no one else did. And so he and I started this thing together and were able to organize our campus. And it's a very simple idea. If you have extra meal points, you should be able to donate them. And the basic logistics are we coach universities, their dining services, and their social services to talk to each other. And once we help them talk to each other, it becomes fairly easy, and they realize it's a worthwhile investment in their student retention and academic outcomes. Our model is very decentralized. We have some of our team in the room today. And if you need a Gentile of the Week, we finally hired a Gentile. It's amazing. and our model is based on students similar to myself going and organizing their campus because we are built off of a new model of nonprofit. We believe that local leaders are the best qualified to build sustainable programs and to identify changes that need to happen on the spot. So when a campus wants to get involved, we only happen if a student and administrator take the lead on the program.
So you are a daughter of the proud Los Angeles Persian Jewish community.
I'm pumping my fists in the air, yes.
Listening to podcasts like ours, and in general, sort of being in the American Jewish world a little bit, do you feel things are insufferably, to use a favorite word, Ashkenormative?
You know, I've been thinking about this. I'm a fan of the podcast. When Stephanie and I met a year ago, and just before we met, I listened to like 10 episodes in a row and have continued to listen since.
And but you said to me, your podcast is extremely Ashkenormative.
And what I've realized is that my experience isn't necessarily one that is or is not Ashkenormative. I mean, from the moment I stepped into my Hillel, I had to learn how to speak Ashkenazi. And then I did Avodah, where I spent a year doing direct service, living in a house with 15 Ashkenazis. And I had to learn how to cook and speak and everything Yiddish and Ashkenazi. And what it did was actually cement my own identity as the only person in the home who spoke to my mom in a different language. So what I really became clear on is that it's not necessarily that I'm not Ashkenazi, it's that I'm a first-generation Jew in America. And what does it mean to be... Judaism is always evolving. I think Jewish identity, we each continue to evolve and own it in our own way. And then what does it mean to be a first-generation Jew doing that? And so I feel like the greatest gift I can give to the Jewish community is to show up in the establishments, the Hillels, the federations, and be myself, because for them to exist, they need to adapt to the needs of today's Jews. And I think first generation Jews have more needs than second or third generation Jews. It's a service to say, let me tell you about my community, because if you claim to represent all Jews, let me have a seat at the table.
So as one of the most Ashkenazi, like actually when we sent off the DNA like kit and everything and it came back, I thought I'd be like, you know, I'd be 2% Viking, 1% Neanderthal, 100% Ashkenazi. Like I got nothing else.
You're
nothing.
Honestly, all you had to do is send a photo of that bow tie and they would have been like, yeah.
I have to say I'm 97.1 and I'm like 1% North African. So
ooh.
Pretty proud of that.
I got nothing else. No flavor in there at all. Just all Ashkenazi, right?
It's like Eastern Europe. Just that's
like,
you.
It's Joe Ashkenazi, right? Like, tell me, and I didn't know any Persians till I got to college. I mean, at all. I barely knew any Jews, but I certainly didn't know any Persian Jews. What are some stereotypes that are false that people have of Persian Jews? And what are some that are, like, true? Like, when you're with other Persians and you see someone, you're like, that person's Persian.
I'll give some stories as examples.
Okay.
So... 2 or 3 years ago, the Jewish Journal, the preeminent newspaper in the Jewish community of LA, put me on their cover and called me one of their mensches of the year. It's a beautiful photo, and the title of the article that they wrote, which the article outlines all the amazing service work that I do, the title of the article was Not a Typical Persian Girl. And...
Dang.
Also, they called you a mensch, which you were like...
And they called me a mensch. And so the response from my end was... to write an op-ed, which the Jewish Journal immediately published, and the title of the op-ed was The Norm, Not the Exception. And it spoke on how many of my friends, I have a group of Persian Jewish women, there's 10 of us, we have an acronym PWITI, Persian Women in Tech and Innovation, and there's a bunch of Persian Jewish women who are doing badass things, and the narrative needs to be updated, right? Because now we're starting to move away from college, because some of the stereotypes are true, right? It took my family many years to realize that what I do, I've been running Swipe Out Hunger for full-time for the past 5.5 years. Only recently did people realize that that is a paid job. They're like, anything that's service, anything that's not real estate or law or medicine, you must be doing for volunteer work, because there's no other reputable career path. So there is absolutely that pressure. I would be remiss to not mention, I was at a Jewish conference 2 weeks ago, and I did not mention that I mentioned that I'm Persian Jewish. I mentioned that I run a nonprofit. I didn't mention that I'm 27 and single. So, like, there is a lot of those pressures that
exist.
Do you
want to mention it now?
I would like to mention that. Okay. For those of you listening who can't see, I'm 5'10", before you send me your grandson. And so the pressures are real, right? The intense, for us, dating outside of the faith, dating outside of the community, intermarriage is dating an Ashkenazi, right? We don't have intermarriage, it's not a problem. And so there is a lot of those stereotypes that we are very exclusive, that we put pressure on our youth. And I want to say that we're starting to change that, because here I am, a Persian Jewish leader who doesn't have a traditional job, who is living in Silver Lake, and is like trying to change that narrative, and it is changing.
When I first met you, a friend had said, you have to meet Rachel, she's amazing. I actually recorded an interview with you. I said something like, oh, you know, all LA Persians are, and I was like, oh, LA Jews, it's just such a wealthy community. You must have just, you know, had a very, I sort of made a lot of judgments and about the life you had. And you told me something that was very surprising.
Yeah, I would say the doing this work of working to end hunger as a Jew, you might assume is just I have good values. But we have become so separated from the story of the immigrant Jew moving to the U.S. And our families, when our families moved here from the U.S., had nothing, right? Like, I was that kid in kindergarten who had the little yellow free lunch ticket, like, clamped in my hand, like, with shame so no one would see. And it was that and other forms of public assistance that gave my parents a peace of mind to go out and achieve the American dream that they were able to achieve. And so the work that I do is, again, very common sense. We're helping students have access to a meal so that they can go and take that placement test, they can go and take the final and succeed academically and get a degree and get a job and have their whole family's lives changed. So it's not something I'm doing just because it's separate. It's very personal, and I've seen it firsthand.
Rachel Somach, thank you so much. Before we let you go, how can people find out more about Swipe Out Hunger?
You can visit swipehunger.org or check us out on Instagram at swipeouthunger. If you're a student who wants to get involved, you can fill out an interest form. Or if you're an alumni of a campus and you want to ask what your alumni association is doing about this, or if you want to help feed students, go on swipeouthunger.org, make a donation, and help us end hunger.
Thank you so much for being
here.
Our Jewish guest is Lauren Miller Rogan. She's an actor, screenwriter, and director whose most recent film is Like Father, starring Kristen Bell and Kelsey Grammer, available on Netflix. It is great. You should watch it. She is also in charge of Hilarity for Charity, which puts on variety shows to raise money for Alzheimer awareness and research. Lauren, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yay. We all very much, we're just talking earlier, we all very much loved Like Father. But it strikes us that it's kind of a departure from a lot of comedy today. It's really kind of an astonishingly earnest film that's very open about its emotional, you know, commitments. Was this something that you kind of, was this like a line in the sand for you? Like, I'm going to make a comedy that will show you guys how, like, a heartfelt comedy needs to feel?
No, I don't think, I did not set out to do that originally, no. Although I wanted to have, you know, sort of these real elements to it that felt a little bit more organic and more dramatic just because the situation, I thought, I don't want to make fun of someone getting left at the altar because that's, I can't imagine that's terrible. And so so it was important to me to portray that in a real way. But honestly, like, it was something that I kind of didn't realize that I had done that, and I was like sitting in the editing room. And I kind of was like, oh, I've made this movie that is really funny, but really sad. And not to like take this down a little, but like that's, I sort of realized that that's kind of my life, that I have these high highs and these low lows and all these things in between. And that's sort of what the movie ended up being. When I was writing it, I was sort of going through this dark time, and it just sort of came out and became this sort of collection of all those different feelings.
Do you, because you wrote the screenplay for it, right?
Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
You directed it,
yes.
Right? So, and you've acted a lot. Is there one of them, I mean, I always think, it's like, I feel like I do one thing, which is I write. And
you podcast too, Mark.
I do podcast, it's true, thank you.
And you wear a great bow tie.
Well, but only the second best bow tie tonight, because the Chazan, the cantor, was really...
It's true.
He had strong bow tie game.
Yeah.
But thank you for noticing.
Sure.
It's Dale,
cantor
yeah, Dale was amazing.
But I'm amazed at all the people in entertainment, in movies and TV, who do seem to do all of those different things. Which one do you think of as your most, which is yourself?
I mean, I think it's taken me a little bit of a journey to get to that realization, because it's like when I was younger, I like wrote a lot of short stories, but I was also kind of an actor and like wanted to do all that. And then I like wanted to be an actor after I graduated from the first part of college. I studied fashion design, and my parents were like, no, why don't you go to film school? And so then I was like,
because that's where the bucks are.
Right. Literally, the thought was, why don't you learn how to support yourself behind the camera when you're not getting the jobs in front of it?
Uh-huh.
And so when I got to film school, I sort of was like, oh, here I am, and these are my people, mm-hmm. and this makes me feel the most like myself. And so I feel like directing kind of, it is all of the things in a way. Like you hire really good people who are really smart and really good at their jobs, but then you get to sort of guest star in their jobs with the production designer and the costume person and the cinematographer and the actors. And so because I am visual and I like words, but I like acting, you know, I guess getting to be the director does make me feel like me.
So you said just a moment ago about how writing the movie felt to you like sort of like replicating the way you experience the emotions, the high highs and the low lows. And here you are, you're sitting in front of a great cast. I mean, Kelsey Grammer, Kristen, like really amazing people. How do you begin to convey what is this very emotional, very intimate feeling that you had when you were sitting at home in front of a computer writing? Be like, okay, well, this is the essence.
Right. I mean, you know, I think it's different for every actor. And so like Kelsey Grammer, who is, these were his words, but he said to me, I have so many wells. And so like before a scene would start, I'd be like, okay, so this is a scene, we're talking about this, whatever. And he would just like start crying. And like, I wouldn't even really have to, I would literally, my job was to not push him further, but to be like, no, no, wait, just hold it in a little bit longer. And like, wait till we're rolling the camera. And then he could just like do it over and over again because he's had a very dramatic life and he is so willing to remember those things and pull things up, and it was like, wow. And then, you know, with Kristen, her process is very different. She's a very optimistic, positive human being and doesn't enjoy going dark and being angry and sad. And so that was a different thing of like trying to sort of work with her and sort of recognize those feelings and sort of, you know, get into those moments and live in them when she wanted to, like, because the thing is like everything she does is perfect. So like you can do it once.
I have to say, my wife and I are in like episode 7 of The Good Place, the first season. And I've seen her in the movie she's been in, and I never really, I think, and maybe this is sexist of me or just superficial, for a long time I was like, she's pretty and she works. And now I'm realizing she's actually an extraordinarily good actor.
Oh no, it's great. I mean, she can be really heartbreaking. And to me, I think what's so interesting is someone who does sort of radiate that positivity that she does. And then when she cries, you're like, oh God, but nothing is right with the world.
Yeah.
And so,
absolutely. You grew up in Florida, right?
Yeah, originally in Long Island, and then I moved to Florida when I was 8.
Where on Long Island?
Setauket, near Stony Brook. Yes.
Does that have valence for you? Do you like, do you feel?
Well, it's not like she was like Roslyn, and I was like, we went to camp together.
So, like, tell it, was your Florida childhood, you know, like Miami, super Jewish?
No,
like,
not at all. No. So I lived on Long Island, like Jewish Mecca, other than Israel, I suppose. And my dad was transferred to Lakeland, Florida, which is in between Tampa and Orlando, when I was 8 years old.
Not Jewish Mecca.
No, to the point where, and my family would always talk about this, but when we moved, the Chamber of Commerce booklet said, churches 300, Jewish churches 1.
Can I just say, you told this story on NPR with Sam Sanders, and he responds being like, so what was your Jewish church like?
Yeah.
And I was like, no. And I was like, we are booking her on this podcast.
She needs some good podcast.
I mean, in their defense, they probably meant like Episcopalians, but that's okay.
Right.
So what was your Jewish church
like? My Jewish church was a lovely place. It was, I mean, a small, tiny community, you know, so My high school, which had 2,200 students, had 5 Jews.
Wow.
And so, you know, so I really didn't have outside of my synagogue a Jewish identity, but within our tiny little tight community, it was fantastic. And I only had, I think it was 6 or 7 people that were my age, but they were like family to me. And I was really big into USY. I did Kadima before USY, but like all the conventions and all the things. And like, and that really,
anything to get out of Florida.
Well, and away from my parents just for a weekend. And I have great parents, but like, you know, to be on your own in high school is
totally
a dream. And so, you know, it was an interesting thing because I felt very connected and very proud when I was there. But in my town, I felt like an outsider. And there was a lot of people just didn't really know what Judaism was. And I faced a fair amount of maybe not direct anti-Semitism, but I would say maybe ignorant anti-Semitism. And it was something that I didn't even... It was like at school, I never wore Star of David to school because I didn't want people asking me about it because they would say weird things and they would ask weird questions. So one time I remember my dentist asked me how Hanukkah worked. And I was like, but you're a dentist. Like, you've been to school. Like, you're going to ask me how Hanukkah works. And like people, one time someone asked if my menorah burnt my Christmas tree. And like people would always, people could not get over that I didn't have a Christmas tree. Like they truly like, but you don't have a Christmas, like they were personally offended that someone could not have a Christmas tree.
I just love the dentist. You're like, you're a dentist. You're practically Jewish. I mean, what's wrong with you?
Speaking of op-eds, but like I literally wrote an op-ed in the paper after that happened because I was like, all right, everyone listen up here. Well, because Merry Christmas, the Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays thing was always a big thing.
I was titled, like, How Hanukkah Works.
Yeah.
You know, you live in California, you're in Hollywood. Is it weird for you to be like among a lot of Jews still?
Well, no, now it's amazing. And so like, so when I graduated from high school, I moved to New York. I went to FIT for a couple years. And so all of a sudden I was like not the Jewish girl. And it was just like, oh, here's another one. And like, and so I suddenly felt at home and comfortable. And when I would go home, that's when I would really like, that's when I really realized it. And now I've been in Los Angeles for 15 years and am surrounded by people who are only like me. And I'm going to Lakeland in a month and I'm actually feeling a bit of anxiety about it.
Your parents are still there?
No, they're here, but I have friends who live there who are like family.
Lakeland should be claiming you as like their successful daughter of Lakeland, right? Like you go off, you make movies, you direct movies. Like.
I don't know. It's a lovely small town, just not a lot of Jews there. But, and you know, but it's nice to be around like-minded people, but at the same time, you know, I have reached out for more diversity on social media and whatnot, and that's always a process.
Totally. Your charity.
Yes.
Would you tell us about it and why, what made you decide to start
I would love to tell you about
Please.
It. It's called Hilarity for Charity, and I started it after my mom, Adele, was diagnosed with younger onset Alzheimer's when she was 55 years old.
Holy cow.
And so it was during sort of this process that I was writing Like Father, sort of in that dark time, so that's how that got woven in there. But, you know, I spent the first number of years of her diagnosis feeling just depressed and angry and just completely without any hope. And then my husband, who is a wonderful human being, and I and some friends threw a variety show, and we had some comedians and musicians. Bruno Mars performed, and we were like, oh, wait, maybe we could raise money for Alzheimer's. And so we created this organization sort of to help people like me who were feeling, I'm so young to be losing a parent to this disease. And I was far from the youngest, of course. And I felt very alone, and I didn't know how to use my voice, and I felt like I was the only one in that circumstance, which is far from the truth. And so we created this organization to give people a voice, and now in our 7 years, we've raised over $10 million, and we've created a grant program where we give away free at-home care to people who can't afford it. We've awarded over 240,000 hours of care to people who can't afford it. We are invest in brain health and prevention research because there's so much that we can do for our brains to keep ourselves healthy as we age. It's something that's given me a tremendous amount of hope where there was none for a long time.
So how old were you when your mother was diagnosed?
I was just before I was 25.
Was it hard for you to find, like, did your friends understand what you were going through?
Because no.
Like, you guys were like out of college, just becoming adults yourselves.
Yeah, no, they didn't understand, and that's no fault of their own. It's just they hadn't experienced it. And the truth is, unless someone has really had a firsthand look at Alzheimer's, it is kind of like impossible to comprehend what it means to lose one's memory. And I think people have a sort of vision of it that is somewhat lighthearted, perhaps from certain television shows and movies. You lose your keys, you put your pants on the wrong way, and that's not the reality that I have faced and that my mom faces and that my dad as her caregiver faces every single day. And so it was really hard and continues to be hard because there is a stigma that surrounds the disease. Many people don't want to talk about it. A young girl who had lost her father to Alzheimer's, who was in an Orthodox community, had shared her story on our website. And her mother made us take it down because she was afraid that her daughter wouldn't find a match if they knew that Alzheimer's was in her family.
It's like the worst thing I've ever heard.
It was pretty upsetting. And so, you know, but this is the fight that we're fighting with Alzheimer's, is that people are so terrified of this disease because there are so few treatments and there is no cure. But there is hope and there are things that are happening. Like I said, there's brain health, there's prevention, there is so much.
And Lauren, you wrote a really beautiful essay that was published on Lenny about how this all started happening at a time when your life was going so well. Your career was just wonderful. You were working on projects. You were happily married. How do you navigate both the happy and the sad, like the way your movie did? How do you do that in real life?
I mean, I think it's just a balance of like that probably everyone faces this happy and sad all the time. And for me, it's just been a practice of being like, it's okay to be sad, and this is the reality, and I get exhausted by it, and I get really dark about it sometimes, but then I have great moments, and I think it's finding that balance of knowing that, like, it's okay that over here I can be sad, but over here I can still be happy, and that sadness can be right alongside me. My mom, the sadness of what is happening to my mom is still part of me, but the goodness of what I've done with Hilarity for Charity, the hope that I found with that is also with me. And that's something that I feel very fortunate to have gotten to experience that. But there can be both at the same time.
You sometimes work with your husband.
Yes.
We're curious if he takes direction well.
It's nice of you, by the way, to give him work. It's very charitable.
That's right.
He really needs work. He's really struggling.
I'm just really curious. Directing is, there are actors who take direction well, there are ones who don't. And some of them might take it well from some people and not from others.
Right.
But I'm curious.
No, I mean, Seth is the most hardworking, talented, and I'm so unbiased, but just so incredible, such an amazing human being. And so we've been together for almost 14 years, so we have a deep connection at this point. I guess we know each other fairly well. And so he's so supportive of me. So the answer is yes, he takes on set. He's an amazing collaborator, and like I was so lucky. I'm so lucky in life just that my husband does what I do and that we do have a great partnership and a respect for what the work that each other does. And so, yes, he takes direction on set very well and in life mildly well. But we had a great time working together. He's a real mensch.
What? I'll just say one of the ongoing questions on our show is what's the feminine of mensch? And we have had people write in and suggest wench, which gets shot down when we put it out there. Or is mensch just neuter at this point? Can it be used for women? It's a problem because one wants a word for women who are mensches.
I don't know. I like when someone says that I'm a mensch.
I think so too.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, but how do you feel about Jewess, the word? Jewess.
I've never thought about it, but my initial reaction was no.
Yes, that's exactly how I feel.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it, but the gut was, I don't want to be
breaking Mark's
Mark is
heart
trying
now.
To bring it back. Yeah. And some women are like, like on Broad City, they're like, we're just two Jewesses. And I'm like, that works for you.
Yeah, it does work for them in a way.
But it does, doesn't it?
But to me, I feel like if I'm a Jewess, I should have like a long cape and like a,
like a big
sort of
J.
Headpiece. Yeah, like a big gaudy J, Star of David or something. Yeah.
What's your next project? Besides your charity, what's your next theatrical or creative project?
I don't know yet for sure. I'm writing a lot. I'm writing a female friendship movie. My husband and I had a friend who moved in with us for a year with her 2.5-year-old after a separation from her husband. I'm writing about that.
You're like, you can live here, but I'm going to write about this.
I know.
Oh, no,
she's thrilled about it. She's like, can I help? Let me pitch stories. So I'm writing a lot.
I love it. Let me do wacky things.
I have a whole email from her. Of like, remember this time? Remember when she did this? Remember when you had to change your diaper? Anyway.
And if people want to know more about Hilarity for Charity?
HilarityForCharity.org. We're on all the social media things. Some form of Hilarity for Charity, you'll find us. Hilarity for Charity, we're out there. And our last Friday show is on Netflix, and you can watch it. Seth Rogen's Hilarity for Charity, if you want to watch our variety show.
So people can watch Like Father on Netflix and then go straight into the variety show next.
Lauren Miller Rogen, thank you so much for being our Jew of the Week.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
We are so excited to have with us tonight our Gentile, Jonathan Croft. He is the executive producer and co-showrunner on ABC's Black-ish. He also worked on How I Met Your Mother and Happy Endings and spent 5 seasons as head writer on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Welcome, Jonathan. Yeah, come up.
Come on up.
Come on up.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. This is like a late night show.
Do the full Conan, baby.
Have to just get this out of the way.
Okay. First of all, I just want to say thank you for having me. This is really cool. I'm really honored. Thank you, Tracy Shimano, for reaching out to me. A friend of mine who said, would you want to do this? And I was like, sure, I'll be a Gentile. And I feel like I have to, before we get started, a little bit, because of the name Jonathan Groff, and I'm a television comedy writer in Los Angeles, there seems to be some suspicion.
That was my first question.
About my Gentile bona fides. Is that what it is? Let me go through some things, okay?
Yeah, okay. Break it down for us.
My father is an Episcopal priest, ooh, so super waspy. I'm married. Okay, thank you. Well, you're keeping score. Okay. My wife is a woman named a tall, 5'10", freckled blonde woman named Martha Blakely Chowning. So, come on.
You had us at Blakely.
Yeah, exactly. And that's like, she actually goes by Blakely.
Oh, so cool, going by your middle name.
Exactly. She's like a soap opera name as a wife.
And her mother was Chava Blackowitz.
What else? Oh, this is big. I don't have a charity to promote at all, so...
So you're a bad person.
That seems pretty Gentile based on the theme tonight.
So you're just
and
like
then I'll tell you a story about my mom. When I was about 13 years old, I grew up in North Jersey, but, you know, we had this little, my dad had this little Episcopal church, and...
Did you live in a rectory?
I lived in a rectory. Wow. Exactly. Very well, very well done.
That is crazy.
If I was a Presbyterian, it would have been the manse.
Is that right? Do Presbyterians have manses?
I think so, yeah. Oh,
wow. Are they bigger? A manse.
No, the Episcopalians have more money, so the rectories are bigger, generally speaking. No, it was a rectory. It was a modest little church. And I got a few Jewish kids that I knew, but it was pretty, you know, and mostly it was actually sort of Sopranos land where I grew up, like Lodi, New Jersey. And that, so that was, gave me a good sense of healthy alienation, I think, enough to become a comedy writer, which is I grew up like this waspy kid around mostly Italian Americans and stuff. But my mom, I remember, back to the Gentile thing, I asked her what a bagel was when I was about 12 or 13, and she said, it's a little round, hard donut. You wouldn't like it.
She's like, we don't eat those.
It's the bread we don't eat on Sunday mornings.
Exactly.
No, okay, now that we have your lineage down, we have to mention, like, you're not the only Jonathan Groff.
No, I am not.
Is
that
problematic for you?
My father, who passed away last year, was very fond. Jonathan Groff is a kind of well-known, wonderful Broadway actor. He's on Glee, and he's a Mindhunter on... Why am I promoting his credit? He's got enough, he should be talking about me. He's got enough going on. But anyway, he's great. I actually got to meet him once, which was really neat. But he, about... 15 years ago appeared out of nowhere, and my manager took great delight in Google alerting me that there was another Jonathan Groff.
You were working for Conan at the time, probably, right?
I was out here. I think it was he sort of emerged about 10 or 12 years ago.
You had a career already, and this
I had a career already.
Pressure comes along.
I still am Jonathan Groff number one on IMDb. I'm going to say that. He's number two. He's Jonathan Drew Groff. I'm Jonathan Carr Groff. But my dad took great pleasure in saying, I saw Jonathan Groff's name in the New York Times today. I'm like, okay, Dad, I know there's another Jonathan Groff.
Like, but, yes, Dad, but they own the media, so there's nothing we could do.
Is the other Jonathan Groff Jewish?
No, he's Isn't Jonathan it? Drew Groff. He's from the same part of the world that my family. I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing that he's not. My family, Groff, is like a Smith, basically, in part of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And he is from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. It's a pretty common surname.
I think he's actually a Mennonite.
He might.
Or
well,
that's raised that, in a Mennonite. I think, I'm not spreading rumors, but.
That is, which, if you think about it, are kind of weirdly Jewish-ish in a way. The whole thing, like, you know, sort of Middle European piety and all that stuff.
The beards,
like,
the hats.
The beards, the hats, the whole thing. Yeah, it's sort of an extension of it on some level. But anyway, he...
Sorry to make you keep talking about the
other that's
Jonathan
okay.
Groff.
I'll talk about Jonathan Groff a whole lot. He's great. My favorite Jonathan Groff story was I had a show that got... I met him. The first time I met him was after Hamilton. I got to go backstage and meet him, and he had a bike helmet on, which I just thought was charming. He was going to bike. He's like the nicest guy. That's the other thing that kind of pissed me off is, like, I'm known as, like, a really nice guy. Like, if you ask... comedy writer, oh yeah, Jonathan Groff, he's a really nice guy, and then, like, he's five times nicer than me. It's really annoying, but
that's a good opportunity for a mid-career turn. Now you could be like the jerk, be like Jonathan Groff.
He's freed me up, Leal. You're right. I am free to be an asshole.
I don't totally
of Jonathan Groff. So my favorite story, one of my favorite Jonathan Groff stories, was I was in New York for some show that I was working on. I think it was Happy Endings, actually. I had gotten picked up, and I was in New York City for the upfronts, so the big television announcements and all that. And I was flying back, and that show was made by Sony Studios. And Sony very kindly had sent a car to pick me up because we were flying in late, returning from New York. And on the flight was Lea Michele, who had co-starred with Jonathan Groff in Spring Awakenings, which was his big Broadway thing that made him famous. And she got down to baggage claim before I did, and there was a limo driver there, a car driver with Jonathan Groff, my name on it. And she's arguing with him because she's friends with Jonathan Groff, saying, like, no, he's not coming out here for another 10 days, I know for a fact, so you should just leave. And I'm like, that's my car. Come on, man. Give me a break.
Anyway. But you clear things up because your Twitter handle is at not that Groff.
It is at not that Groff, yes.
All right, so let's talk about this Groff.
Which is pretty good, but Liel's got at Liel, right?
You do?
Right, yeah.
Yes.
How do you spell Liel?
L-I-E-L.
There was nobody else
Well, when you have very few friends and you spend a lot of time in front of a computer and hanging with nerds, and it's like 2009 and someone's like, you want to be on Twitter? And you're like, yes, because I have nothing else going on. That's how you get that.
Early adopter.
Yeah, early adopter.
You could have been like at God.
Right.
Okay. Let's talk about this Jonathan Groff here with us tonight. How'd you get involved with Black-ish?
I had four failed pilots that I had been involved with in the spring of or winter, whatever, of 2013, 2014, and had even then gone on to produce another pilot that was lovely that failed. So I really went 0 for 5, and I was a little bit licking my wounds, and I was in a deal at ABC Studios, and they said, you know, you're going to develop again, right? Another thing. I'm like, I guess. And I said, but can I just hide out on a show for a little while? And I met Kenya Barris, who created Black-ish, and Larry Wilmore, who helped him get it on the air. He was involved with the pilot and a bunch of the first episodes, actually. And I just said, yeah, can I work here a few days a week while I lick my wounds and figure out what I'm going to do? And then as I was working there, all of a sudden Larry had gotten this opportunity to get a show on Comedy Central, the nightly with Larry Wilmore, and he was leaving. And Kenya, who had never run a show before, had been working in television and was brilliant, but he was like, would you want to run this with me and help me do it? And I was at first like, I don't know if I want to run another show, that's a lot of work. But I met Anthony and Tracy, and we did a few table reads and started shooting a couple episodes, and I liked the stories and I was relating to it, and you know, and I fell in love with it, and I said, please, I would love to stay. And so I've been there. You know, I didn't run the show last year, but I've basically been running it pretty much, or co-running it with Kenya, and this year and Corey Nickerson was helped to run it in seasons 3 and 4. And then this year, a guy named Kenny Smith is running it with me. So
you come from late night comedy,
yes,
which is sort of like the highest metabolism kind of, yep, a writer, especially a comedy writer, can have. So I'm imagining, you know, here you are going to a sitcom and maybe thinking, okay, well, this would be an opportunity to sort of more luxuriate and like put your kind of like your craft into it and kind of like take a breather. And then Trump happens and Black-ish becomes one of the most kind of like engaged political shows on TV. Did you have a moment in which you thought, I thought I was getting away from this? I thought I was just telling a story about a family in America and all of a sudden we're at the forefront.
That's a great question. I think I was ready for that challenge. I had worked on, I mean, Conan's show was of the moment, and we sort of dabbled into politics a little bit, but it was pretty silly and pretty sketch oriented. And Conan was never interested, I don't think, in doing what Stephen Colbert does or Jon Stewart did, or, you know, it's just not what his thing was. Could do that, he's brilliant, but he wanted to sort of do this sketchier, funny, you know, pure comedy thing. And so I never really had the opportunity. And even things like Scrubs, which I worked on, or How I Met Your Mother, or, you know, I'd really been in the world of Happy Endings, very much of like young 20-somethings and 30-somethings and their world, and super funny shows, and I was really proud of them, super funny cast and great writers to work with. So actually to do a family show was really refreshing and exciting, and that's one reason I got so energized by the opportunity. And then to follow it up and have a family show that was really about something, and then who knew? I mean, I will say, even before Trump, we were in a world of reacting to the Ferguson, you know, or reacting to the shootings in Charleston, you know, the murders of the churchgoers in Charleston, and trying to wrap our minds around what was happening in our country even in advance of the rise of Trumpism. So, and then, so we did a wonderful episode that Kenya Barris wrote called Hope that was in our second season that was really more about a Ferguson, post-Ferguson, sort of the family watching television, waiting to see what the verdict was going to be in a fictional trial, though we got Don Lemon actually to present the story as the episode went on, and they were watching CNN. So even pre-Trump, we were doing some stuff. But then once that happened, we really felt more and more like we need to engage. But, you know, it isn't what we do all the time. We really are just trying to tell this story of this family and how they're in the world and they're dealing with, you know, the basic DNA of the show is Kenny Barris looked around and he's a guy who grew up in Inglewood and Anthony Anderson grew up in Compton. And both of them were sort of saying, like, we've given our kids all of this. What have we lost by what we've gained? How are our kids not who we thought we are? Are we okay with that? And going down that road.
When the show started, by the way, I'm a huge fan of it. I wrote a piece saying that Black-ish is the show I really wish the Jewish community would make because it's so incredibly honest about asking that question. And I think we sort of grapple with, but much less kind of upfront about it.
Don't you think there are things that have done that, though? I mean, imagine, like, just, I don't know, I would imagine.
I don't know recently, and yeah. I don't know in, like, massive popular
culture.
Well,
there was the pilot of Black-ish where there was, like, a bar mitzvah.
Right, that's right.
So we had that.
You did it for us.
That's true.
Live actually, from the rectory.
That's so funny. Yeah. I had nothing to do with that pilot. Yeah, one of the storylines is that Junior, Marcus Scribner's character, is so kind of, like, assimilated really into this white school that, and his best friend is Zach, and he wants to, you know, asks his dad, Junior does, can I get bar mitzvah? And it's like, what is this? And they end up having, and Anthony Anderson's character, Dre, wants to end up having like sort of an African manhood initiation ritual to kind of counterbalance that. And they end up having a bro mitzvah at the end of the pilot, which is really funny. And
it was great.
Yeah.
That's what we need, more Jewish shows. More Jewish shows. Thank you.
I was actually sort of bar mitzvahed. This is where I give
up. This is always what happens.
I know. See, I'm blowing it, but I feel Episcopal priest, Martha Blakely Chowning. Can I? Okay. Yeah. I had my friends in college, Jack Schwartzman, Jennifer Moses, Steve Beal, and Betsy Apple said, it's a shame that you were never bar mitzvahed. And so they had a sort of honorary, for my birthday, which came during final exams freshman year, they had like an honorary bar mitzvah and they played like aging, you know, relatives of mine who were, you know, singing my praises, and they made me give a little speech.
They made like a video reel for the
It was live. We had like a party and they did like a live bar mitzvah.
You guys really went wild in college, huh?
All right, so it's a little silly to ask you this because you've probably met a few Jews in the comedy world. Yeah. We're probably not your first Jews. But is there, you know, we always give the Gentile of the Week a chance to ask, do you have any questions about Judaism that we can answer for you? I mean, sometimes there's just that thing you've always been a little shy about asking it. You don't know if it's cool to ask. This is a safe space, like your writer's room, no doubt.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, anything we can tell you?
Well, I think an interesting question, I think it's because I grew up kind of where in the, you know, my dad was a clergyman and not a strictly religious background, but like we had the sort of comforting notion of heaven and an afterlife was presented to us as kids. When my grandpa passed away when I was 5 in 1967, I just told how old I was. Can you edit that out? This is Hollywood. My parents were like, yeah, he's gone. You'll see him again and he's in heaven. And like the notion of an afterlife is something that is, I think, for parents, although I didn't really say that to my kids when their grandparents passed because I have my own questions and I whatever, but I do think that is, what do you say, basically? I think, what do parents say to kids? Because as I understand it, not the biggest tenet of Judaism in most of its forms.
We don't have a hell per se.
Right.
We have a sort of the world to come, and in Torah we have a Gehenna, which is actually just a valley in Israel where apparently souls rested, but we don't. I want to hear what Liel would answer, and then I want to ask Rabbi Nolan, who, by the way, is the most Jewish first name I've ever heard.
is it Rabbi?
Which he, what they say, how do you answer?
I think we should outsource it to Rabbi
Should
Nolan.
We just outsource it purely to Rabbi Nolan?
Yeah, ask a rabbi.
Yeah, you want to come up here and tell us what do you, or?
You thought you were done for the night.
Josh is going to hook you up. We were going to name our kids Nolan, but we thought it was too Jewish. It would just mark him. The anti-Semites would be able to find him.
First of all, I love standing in the back of the room. This is an absolute treat for me. I always preface what I'm about to say. Judaism doesn't say anything because there are many, many Judaisms, and we've been blessed with a tradition of 3,000 years of rabbis who love to talk and write and pontificate. So there are rabbis like mystical Isaac Luria, the Ari, who does talk about an afterlife, who does talk about the soul and Gilgul and what happens to the soul immediately after death. And then there are I'd say the vast majority of rabbis who basically believe that the Torah closes the door on afterlife and wants us to focus on this life and perfecting this world, which is why there's only one allusion in the Torah itself to some other world, and that's in the story of Korach.
Baruch Hashem.
You could just say that, you know, the afterlife's like Otisville prison. Like, Bubby can't get out, but the food is kosher. It's fine.
It's not Zabar's.
It's not Zabar's.
Not Zabar's. My kid's idea of the afterlife comes from the children's book Dog Heaven, because in Dog Heaven, the squirrels are slow. And that's basically like that sort of... they haven't lost any people, thank God, but that's where they think our dogs go. So, Jonathan Groff, if people were to start with one episode of Black-ish, let's say we have a listener who hasn't heard or hasn't even heard of the show because they've been just in yeshiva studying, and they're looking to go off the derech, off the path, and do something secular and sinful, what episode would you start them with?
You're asking me to choose, you know, which of my
babies. Of your children, yeah.
I know. The pilot that Kenya wrote is wonderful, but I'd have to add, I don't know, I think the Hope episode, which I referenced earlier about police brutality, is a really beautiful, simply shot and well-told story of the family, and you get everybody's there. Lawrence Fishburne's there, and Jennifer Lewis, who plays the grandma, who's amazing, and we had Yara Shahidi still because it was the second season of the show, and it was just really well done and very dramatic at places, but then as comedy can do, like the laughs are pretty good because they're breaking the tension.
Yeah. Preacher's Kid, Jonathan Groff, thank you for being our Gentile of the Week.
My pleasure. This is great. Thank you, Mark.
So before we conclude the show, you know that we do Mazel Tovs. Our first Mazel Tov, we actually have one, which is to our producer, Joshua Cross, who joined us pretty much a year ago today. And we just want to give him a round of applause. He's taken us to new...
I don't know if you've noticed, if you listened to it, he's the reason we have tons of special episodes, like our conversion episode, our Jews Across America episode. He's really taken us to the next level sonically, and we are very grateful.
Absolutely. But look, we hand the Mazel Tov. So wait, I actually have a Mazel Tov. Do you have one? Do you have one?
Basically, we hear that David Asher is becoming a bar mitzvah. We are invited, but we can't make it. It's out in California in a few weeks, and we unfortunately can't make it back, but we're really excited for him.
Mazel Tov, David Asher.
And he has a great invitation.
Mazel Tov.
And then we have time for a few from the audience, and this is our last thing of the night. So if anyone, we have a microphone back there and a microphone there. Don't be shy. This is your chance to reach 12 million Jews. No, just kidding. Not really every Jew in the world. That's how many Jews there are, more or less. Mazel Tov, sir, tell us your name and where you're from and who the Mazel Tov is for.
Adam Diamond, here from Los Angeles, and I'd like to give a Mazel Tov to my sister, Helen Geyer, who just won a Casting Society of America award yesterday for casting for the limited series Godless, which I've actually never seen.
Wow.
Amazing. Mazel Tov.
You haven't seen it? He hasn't seen it.
He should really see it.
Yeah, he's some brother.
I'm actually going. This is Tracy Shimano, and I'm going to take advantage of the fact that I was given a microphone. I have a few Mazel Tovs, and I'm going to make them really, really fast. The first Mazel Tov is to my husband, David Shimano. He started his own law firm a year ago, and he is the happiest I've ever seen him in the nearly 24 years that we've been married. I want to give an additional Mazel Tov to Daniel Jan and Jonathan Shimano, my babies, who have not complained at all about the cold on their East Coast college campuses. And finally, no, not finally, I'd like to give a Mazel Tov to my parents, Sandy and Ira Goldstein, who just celebrated their 60th anniversary. And finally, I would like to give a Mazel Tov to Stephanie, Mark, and Liel, who have clearly, I have not missed an episode in 3.5 years, and this is the best episode they have ever done.
Thank you.
So, Mazel Tov to you three.
Hi, I'm Shira. I'm from LA. I am fangirling so hard right now. I'm really excited just to see you guys in person. I want to give a Mazel Tov to my husband because Super Proposal Sunday is our 3-year engagement anniversary. So Mazel Tov.
Wait, Sunday you'll have been engaged for 3 years?
Well, it's our engagement anniversary.
But you're now married.
For 2 years.
Okay, did you have to...
Mazel Tov.
Still counts.
I have a question. Did you have to watch the Super Bowl after? Like, was it during?
It was, yes, I'll marry you. Does this mean I don't have to see the game? And then he said yes. And then I said, yes, I'll definitely marry you.
As you know, as a fan of the show, Sid and I got engaged on Yom Kippur. So, you know, I'm all for theologically weird.
I'm pretty sure that's, like, illegal.
Yeah, right. Any others?
No, wow, no other
Do you mazel want to give
tov.
A mazel tov to anyone, Jonathan?
Oh,
Jonathan.
You know, I was afraid you were going to say that. Sure. I don't know. I'll give a mazel tov to my two children who are working hard, doing their very best in school and in all their activities. That's Maddie, who's a first year in college, and my son Edwin, who is a sophomore in high school.
Nice. Mazel tov to them.
I want to wish a mazel tov to all my friends who are here. My cousin Nicole, Tammy, Kimberly, Kelsey. I'm just so happy to see them. It's so fun. And Danya, of course.
Of course.
It's our friends Gabby Berkner and Christopher Noxon. Thank you so much for hanging with us.
Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, we have one more. It's Leah.
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Leah Phillips. I'm going to say a mazel tov to my husband, Michael Phillips, because we just celebrated the 10th anniversary of his 21st birthday. And it was a
lot
of fun.
In Judaism, that's actually a very important day, the 10th anniversary of your 21st birthday.
And it was super fun, and we're obviously big fans and are so excited you guys are here.
Happy birthday.
And
happy.
Leah, we have a mazel tov to you because your mother, Judy Paz, is part of who made this event possible. And she really just did it so that you would come see her on a Friday night.
Come home, yeah.
You're not wrong.
Well, thanks to all of you. We're so excited you came out tonight. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine on the web at tabletmag.com. You can ask for our newsletter by writing to unorthodox@tabletmag.com and putting newsletter in the subject line. We often come to you live, like tonight. To book us or to advertise with us, email producer Josh Cross. That's Cross with a K, jcross@tabletmag.com. And of course, you should wear and carry Unorthodox too. Go to bit.ly/unorthoshirt and find the latest in Unorthodox shirts, mugs, and onesies. No baby is too young to be a billboard for our show. Follow us on Instagram @UnorthodoxPodcast and on Twitter @Unorthodox_pod. Join our Facebook group. Our show is produced by Josh Cross, Jira Toloshkin, and Noah Levinson. Our editor is Sophia Steinert-Evoy. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our social media intern is Elazar Abrams over there in the promised land. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our mailbox theme is by Steve Barton. Rabbinic supervision by Rabbi Nolan Leibovitz of Adat Shalom. We usually come to you from Argo Studios right there in the Flatiron District, but tonight, Adat Shalom in sunny Los Angeles. Shalom, friends.